afternoon. Thank you so much for coming back to campus. We are super excited to have you and looking forward to a really fantastic reunion weekend. So thank you so much for being here. I'm here to introduce Paul A. Schroeder Rodriguez, who is a professor of Spanish here at Amherst College. His research focus is Latin American cinema, and his contributions to the field include a book on Cuba's foremost film director, as well as the first comprehensive history of Latin American narrative cinema. The Modern Language Association recently honored the latter as a, quote, tour de force that explores the cultural, economic, and artistic evolution of Latin American cinema, end quote, a timely and excellent contribution to the field, demonstrating breadth and a deep knowledge of the medium's social and cultural contexts. His most recent publication is an essay titled A Borderlands History of Latinx Cinema, just published in the Oxford Handbook of Latino Studies. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Paul A. Schroeder Rodriguez.
Thank you for that wonderful intro. So I was born in the beautiful island of Puerto Rico in the Caribbean Sea, born and raised there. And I went to college in the U.S. in D.C. Then I went to Germany for a couple of years to work. Did you like it? Came back to the States to do grad studies, first in Arizona and then in California. Got my first job in Honolulu, Hawaii. 8 wonderful years. Then I went to Chicago for 8 years after that. And I've been at Amherst for 3 years now, so I'm kind of like inching my way back to Puerto Rico, I think. And this course is part of that. So I really enjoy this course. So how did this course come about? When I arrived here, this is a very homogeneous culture in Western Mass compared to some other places I've lived in. And I looked around and I heard this town called Holyoke, which in effect is 50%, over 50% Puerto Rican. And if you go to the high school, it's over 90% student body Puerto Rican. So most of the non-Puerto Ricans don't go to the public high school, they go to the Catholic schools. In any case, the dean of the faculty made a call for faculty to propose courses that incorporate a travel component as part of an initiative to internationalize the curriculum. And so I have been thinking about, I want to do something with Holyoke, and this was a good opportunity to do that. So I presented a proposal, it was accepted, and this is the course description. Puerto Rico's colonial relationship to the United States has generated waves of migration to the point that today, more Puerto Ricans live in the United States than on the island. In this course, we will examine the literary and cultural manifestations of this diaspora. The course will integrate a community-based learning component in partnership with the Holyoke Public Library, which is working to preserve and make available artifacts and stories about Puerto Ricans in Holyoke. As part of this community component, students will conduct oral history interviews in Holyoke and then travel to Puerto Rico during spring break in order to visit relatives of the interviewees, share this knowledge, interview them in turn, and bring the gathered oral histories and artifacts back to Holyoke for sharing and archiving. During the trip to Puerto Rico, we will also conduct cultural visits directly related to the course material. And this was a course in Spanish, of course. And so I divided the course into 3 parts. Learning interview skills, we had to begin that very early in the semester because we were going to Puerto Rico in spring break in March. And the course started in late January. Then we conducted the interviews here and on the island, and then when we got back, we devoted the rest of the semester on post-production. They had the option of doing one documentary as a class or several documentaries, and they decided that they would do one documentary. And then we took that, we screened that documentary in Holyoke Public Library and invited all, of course, all the people who have been interviewed and their families. And then the next day, we showed it here at Keith Auditorium Theater for the Amherst community. And I'll show you the first 3 minutes of the 20-minute documentary.
There is a very tight-knit community. In Texas, like I said, I felt extreme pride for who I was, even though there were, like, instances of shame. Like, I was like, yeah, I'm Puerto Rican. Like, I'm a Boricua. Like, this is, like, the best part of me. Like, I never really identified, like, even though I am, like, I never really was like, I'm American. I was like, no, Puerto Rican. I'm not from Texas. I'm from Puerto Rico, even if I haven't been there in years.
Pero ser puertorriqueño es tan rico, porque tener una la cultura se ha enriquecido de tantas culturas, que es una multicultura. Porque aquí tenemos africano, español y taíno.
You know, it was always weird, like, introducing myself to people and explaining my heritage. Like, I'm half Puerto Rican, half Honduran. You know, you're half Puerto Rican. Like, a lot of people see you that way, especially in the Bronx, right? Because it's a big part of, like, there are not that many Hondurans, so when I would say I'm half Puerto Rican, half Honduran, people would, like, most immediately, like, see me as a Puerto Rican, first and foremost, even though I don't really identify as that. But coming here to the island and, like, speaking to, like, some of the Puerto Ricans here and, like, telling them my story, and they're so, like, warm and inclusive, like, yes, like, you know, we've been waiting for you, and it's, like almost like an extended family. It's, like, you know, it's a lot.
Una pregunta fuerte, porque ser puertorriqueño es ser muchas veces lo que tú conoces desde que naciste, que es criarte en un barrio donde el campo es lo que te rodea, pero cuando cruzas el mar, que llegas acá, muchas veces es sentirte rechazada, es de sentirte perdida porque no conoces el idioma. La familia está lejos.
Porque Puerto Rico posee un puntito, y tú miras de perto.
That's David's brother.
Yes.
So he's the brother of Peter Marvin's colleague in IT. So the students. Wait, hold on. These are some testimonials from students. Jeffrey is the one who talked about being from the Bronx, half Honduran. Silvia Mavares is a Venezuelan-American. The most challenging part so far has been choosing which parts of each interview to include, since it is difficult to accurately portray such dense and meaningful stories in a short documentary. And so we had hours and hours and hours, as you can imagine, of talking head interviews, and it was a very interesting discussion. How do we make a narrative out of this? So the documentary, they decided, would be divided into three parts. The first part, what it means to be Puerto Rican, and another part about the politics on the island, and the other part, I can't remember. And Hannah Firestone, who just graduated, this course has been one of the most impactful experiences I've had at Amherst. Nothing can compare to interacting with and learning from people who have had different experiences from you. The Puerto Rican diaspora is unique, varied, and beautiful. And this is some, one of the big takeaways from the course, I think, and a really transferable skill, is that students, you know, we devoted a lot of time talking and practicing interviewing skills, asking questions that produce more interesting answers, listening carefully, following up when appropriate, and starting from a place of empathy and ending there as well. Across cultures and across languages, because these were mostly students whose first language was English. Actually, there was only 2 out of the 12 students had Spanish as their first language. And I have to say that this kind of course where you take students abroad, you can't do it by yourself, so I had tons of help. This is a list in chronological order, so I have never taught a class where we create documentaries, so I signed up for an online course with a group called Civic Life Project, that whose goal is to teach faculty who teach in the humanities how to incorporate documentaries into their courses. At Amherst IT, Information Technology, Peter Morgan and David Perez Ortiz, the Amherst CGE, that's Community Center for Community Engagement, something like that. Megan Lister and Sarah Barr. So they really helped me reach out to organizations in Holyoke to identify and then to get to know them, to see, you know, if they could help us find the people in Holyoke who would be interesting characters for the documentary. The Amherst Office of Global Education and its director, Jana Behrens. Spanish Studies Abroad, which is a local company that provides services for study abroad. They're right here in Amherst. And they have an office here and an office in Sevilla, Spain, with a big program in Spain. They also have programs in Puerto Rico and Argentina and Cuba. So the director who is in Spain, Michelle Duran, she's class of 93, Spanish department major. And Chris Butko, who is a student who graduated that spring, who is a film and media studies major, and he really polished, after the students had put all the clips together and what have you, he went in and he polished it so it looked really professional. So what happened after the course? The students were happy, I was happy, I was exhausted because we went during spring break and then came back Sunday after midnight to teach on Monday, and no break really for any of us. And so I was telling myself, I don't think I can do this again. I'm not that young anymore. But, you know, next semester, students started approaching me. When are you going to teach that class again? I heard such great things about it. So that got me thinking, and I knew I wouldn't do the same class again, because even though I was very happy with the documentary, and we shared it with the community, and it's online for people to see if people are interested, it felt like I wasn't doing enough service learning. The amount and the quality of service learning that I had in mind, the potential for more in-depth service learning and community engagement. So, and I also was starting to get very interested in climate change as the most important issue of our times, certainly the most important issue for students that I teach. And so I started thinking, how can I combine these two interests in climate change and Puerto Rico and social justice? And so I asked Rick Lopez, because he is a professor of history, dean of new students, but I asked him not because of that, but because he's also a professor in environmental studies and he knows Spanish, and he's a Latin American. So I said, Rick, what do you think of co-teaching a course on climate change and social justice in Puerto Rico, and we take students to Puerto Rico? He said, I'd love to, but I can't. I got too many responsibilities. But I recommend that you talk to Ashwin Ravinukar, who We just hired him a year and a half ago, I think, from in Chicago, the equivalent of the National History Museum there. I can't remember the exact name of the museum, but he works in the Peruvian Amazon with communities who are living in the forest and who know a lot about the forest. But then he brings in, so he learns from them, but he also brings in a lot of scientific knowledge. And so it's a really collaborative effort. And so we put our heads together and came up with this proposal for a course that we will teach in spring 2020. In September 2017, Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico and laid bare the social inequalities that have been growing since the Great Recession of 2008 and before. But the hurricane has also accelerated efforts to seek alternative sources of food and fuel and avoid a repeat of the post-hurricane shortages linked to the overdependence on food imports and a crumbling energy grid. Students in this course will analyze and evaluate how three such efforts have fared. One small grassroots organization, one large not-for-profit organization, and one government agency. The findings may have far-reaching implications beyond Puerto Rico as centralized power grids throughout the world enter the end of their useful life. Begging replacement with new innovative systems that do not contribute to climate change. Except that students must commit.
Here you go.
Must commit. So we'll take them to Puerto Rico during interterm in January, and then come back, and we'll study in depth those three organizations. And at the end of the semester, students will share their findings with a diverse audience of stakeholders and interested parties. So we have yet to define how that will be. It'll take several forms, I'm sure. And the organizations are Casa Pueblo, a grassroots organization in a small town in southern Puerto Rico called Ajuntas. Para la Naturaleza, which is a big not-for-profit that is similar to the Nature Conservancy in vision and mission. Specifically, and they have a lot of money, like the Nature Conservancy. Specifically, their vision is to reforest Puerto Rico 70% of the land with native flora by the year, I don't know, it's like in 50 years, that's the plan. So they have several greenhouses throughout the island, depending on the niche ecosystem, because there's several ecosystems on the island. And so one of the things we'll be doing is learning how they do that and also volunteering, planting trees and things like that. If you go to Puerto Rico, I would look them up because they also do tours of sites that have cultural and natural interest. And they are very, very, very well set up. And finally, the Puerto Rico Department of Natural Resources. So that concludes my presentation. Thank you very much. And we have 30 minutes for our Q&A. Yes?
Do we have access to the video through the Amherst College website?
Yes. The Amherst magazine did a story on this class, which has much more in-depth descriptions and testimonials from students. There's a version of it in the print magazine that came out, I think, summer or fall of 2018. And then if you go online and Google, you know, Puerto Rico Diaspora Nation, Amherst College, I'm sure you'll get to that, to the web version of the article. And you can watch the video, the 20-minute documentary there as well. Yes.
Can you say some more about what is happening in the alternative energy areas following the devastating hurricane?
Yes, so I know a little bit, but I want to find out a lot more when I teach this class. So, you know, that what's getting a lot of attention in the news is the owner of Tesla has offered to help, I mean, to sell solar technology to Puerto Rico. These are mid-sized operations. So not like right now, Puerto Rico has and has had for many years one big power plant. You know, the hurricane destroyed it on the distribution system. So there's a lot of talk now. Do we go back to that one plant model? Do we look for regional power plants? Do we focus instead on the ground, individual family putting up solar panels on their roofs? And the answer is that there will be a combination of all three. Yes. And the most interesting path forward, in my mind, is the one that gives the power to people to really have their own power at their own home. So there's new technologies that are developing very quickly. Before, you used to, if you wanted to store the solar energy for use at night, for example, in a regular home, you would need maybe half of the basement to fill with the battery. The batteries were so big. That was not even 3 years ago. Now, I've seen reports in Puerto Rico where they have these batteries that are about this wide and about this tall, and they hang on the wall. That's not Elon Musk's company, that's another company. So one of the things we'll do when we visit is to visit the big power plant and visit some of these companies that are working on solar power. That organization in southern Puerto Rico, in Juntas, Casa Pueblo, they run 100% solar power. After the hurricane, they were the only place where you could go plug your cell phone for many, many, many miles around. So people from neighboring towns would come in as well, plug in their cell phone. They have their radio station running on solar, so people would learn what was going on in their town, and they would release disappeared people who reappeared. That kind of community information really was not being done by the government. It was being done by a grassroots organization like that one. So we'll look at that as well. Yes?
What's the potential of Puerto Rico becoming the 51st state?
That, I don't know. That's a long answer I would have to go into. But in Puerto Rico, when I grew up there, about half of the population who went to vote voted typically for the party that wanted annexation to the states as a state, and the other half voted for the status quo, meaning this colonial thing called the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico. And then 1 or 2% would vote for the party that wanted independence. That hasn't changed much in 50 years. It's incredible, not 50. Yeah, 40 years. It's incredible. It hasn't changed. The percentages are still the same. I can't figure out why, when things have changed so much. What has changed is the argument in favor of one or the other. So when I was growing up, the argument was that if we were to become a state, we would be equal citizens to citizens in the mainland and Hawaii and what have you. Now the argument you hear more and more is if we have statehood, we'll be able to engage in the political process with our representatives in Washington, D.C. So it's not so much about equality, but about having access to power. Yes?
Has that changed at all since our woeful response in NCAAs beyond our president tossing out their towel?
We'll find out next year.
So there haven't been...
Not since that year ago. Now the next elections, they coincide with the U.S. presidential elections.
And it was actually two hurricanes, right?
Yes, Irma, which was not, of course, as impactful. That's why we don't hear about it. And then Maria. Yes.
I had the figure in mind that that Maria hurricane caused something like $90 billion of damage to Puerto Rico. How much aid has gone to Puerto Rico from the U.S. government?
There's been some aid that has been earmarked, but has not made it to Puerto Rico. And I don't know the exact numbers, but it's not even half of what has been earmarked has made it to Puerto Rico, and right now there's a discussion in Congress about what to do with additional aid. So.
But I thought that it was something around $1.9 billion that was offered in this recent package, and it seems such a tiny fraction of what I took to be the correct figure, maybe $19 billion.
Yeah. You know, I don't know the exact figure, but I have heard not $19 billion, but no. Yeah, I can't say. I think I'm thinking right now of the debt. What is the amount of Puerto Rican debt? And that's a lot more than that. Yeah, I'll have to look into it. Maybe we can exchange emails, and I'll let you know what I find.
Do you think the migration from Puerto Ricans to Miami, Florida, in general, is going to have an impact in the elections? I mean, they're
in
not going to
vote Florida elections.
What's that?
In the Florida elections?
Yes.
I would hope so, but the Republican governor of Florida is very savvy, and he went to Puerto Rico, I think, 8 times after Maria, and he has been very visible and vocal about helping Puerto Ricans who arrive in Florida. So we'll see. We'll see next year. I hope people see beyond the good faith of the governor to look at the policies, because if they do, then they will not vote for the governor of Florida again, or for the Republican ticket. Yes.
I wonder if you could comment on the attitude of Puerto Ricans toward Trump's anti-immigrant attitude, and indeed his slighting comments on people south of the Mexican border and otherwise people who are not descendants of Europeans.
Yes, I don't know any Puerto Rican who has anything positive to say about Trump. And I know a lot of Puerto Ricans of all social classes and all political inclinations.
Could you maybe make a more specific comment about that?
Yeah.
I have a couple of points, and then hopefully they inspire elaboration. But the first one, I guess, is that the comparison of para la
Naturaleza
to the Nature Conservancy sounds like a really good endorsement to me, because I was lucky to be part of the Aspen Institute series on the environment back in the 90s, which took a lot of really top people from environmental, private, and government sectors and really revised the whole regulatory process of EPA on down. And I remember the regional director of EPA at San Francisco Region 8, John Weiss, telling me that the Nature Conservancy was really, in his mind, like the one environmental group that was still totally pristine and trustworthy to him in how they operated, transparency, et cetera.
Yes, and they're very careful not to be partisan. Their goal is very,
Well, I like to stir it up. I really enjoyed putting the Greenpeace guy by the Exxon guy, and they both found out they like fly fishing and stuff like that.
Okay.
But my second thing was that I just to compliment you, that I thought it was a very inspired decision the way that you changed and adapted the course, because of course every new student would love to be in a documentary and have their their sound bites, etc. But it sounds to me that it's really a greater contribution to the students' future and to society, as well as keeping you sane and, you know, and living longer, to really, yeah, turn it into something for the future, something evolutionary, where they can still learn the interview skills, still go to Puerto Rico, etc. But then there's not like an endpoint, which is the documentary. It's more like then they engage with these organizations that are actually making differences in people's lives, and then that can turn into careers for them, or they can become mentors for future students. And it just seems to me like a really inspired decision that you made and to reach out to.
Thank you. I couldn't have said it better.
In the slide presentation, there's a word that I don't recognize as a Spanish word, and I'm familiar with an organization of the same name, Palante. There's an organization in Manhattan that I'm familiar with. Palante stands for, it's an acronym, People Against Landlord Abuse and Tenant Exploitation. And they work to, landlords that don't have apartments that are up to spec, no heat and that sort of thing, or who evict people for inadequate reasons and things like that. And I think they do good work, and it's a grassroots organization founded by a combination of Puerto Ricans and Dominicans in northern Manhattan. And I was curious, I'm not sure the context you used it. Is it actually have a specific translation, or is it also an acronym?
So Palante is a phrase that people use all the time, and it became like a meme after the hurricane, because it was like Palante, it's like we go forward against all these odds. Para adelante, so it's a contraction of para adelante, go forward. And so they turned that into an acronym. That was pretty smart. Yes.
So I noticed one topic you had excluded, and I think someone alluded to it, was sort of the financial structural situation down there, the rapid and massive accumulation by U.S. hedge funds of bonds, et cetera, and sort of the imbalance of power with the, both the government bonds and the energy company bonds. Did you specifically want to stay away from that, to stay more down on the social level?
No, we'll look at that, because that is the big picture. We'll look at that in the class. Yes.
One of the, I appreciated your comment saying just about the, I'm also from the Bronx, and, you know, not Puerto Rican, but in a Puerto Rican neighborhood, and had a sense of that piece of diaspora. And I was also fascinated when I did go to visit the island to actually visit my Amherst College roommate, who was from the island, how different the island culture and the Barican culture was, and especially around some of these political issues around statehood. And I guess I was just curious about how, if you've seen the sort of the dialogue on statehood change, because I thought it was fascinating that there was an island where our normal sort of divide of politics, whether around taxes or abortion or five other social issues, you know, that there was this other issue that just totally changed, you know, how people sorted themselves politically. And I don't know if that's changed since the events of the hurricane in the last couple of years, in your perception, or what the students have been seeing, both in the diaspora and in the island.
Yeah, I have seen a big change. As I mentioned before, people are now asking the question of, right, how do we get to the halls of power to change things from within, and not wait for the order to come down to us. Another big change is in the attitude of a lot of Puerto Ricans in the United States, who historically have supported independence, historically. Even if, you know, they're here in the States, they can't vote in Puerto Rican elections because they're here, but their hearts, you know, most of them will tell you, I probably wouldn't vote for independence, but that's what I want if I have the chance to vote in Puerto Rico. After Maria, I've heard more and more people say, and I've read about this too, that independence, it's we're in another historical context now. More Puerto Ricans live in the U.S. than in Puerto Rico. Every Puerto Rican has family in both Puerto Rico and the United States. So to talk about independence means severing families at this point in history. And so that's been a game changer, the demographics. And then just the hurricane just accentuated that. Yes?
Do people have access to Medicaid or health support in Puerto Rico? It seems to me, when I was seeing patients, my practice, a lot of them came there because they couldn't find a place to go. They would go to Shriners Hospital in Springfield. But it seems to me that, I don't know what their eligibility for Medicaid is in Puerto Rico. They get Medicaid.
Well, it's a lot less available in Puerto Rico because of the budget crisis. But really what happened with the hurricane, the big impact was that the electricity went out. And hospitals had generators, but then gasoline ran out.
But this was before the hurricane.
Before the hurricane. It's hard to get a doctor's appointment in Puerto Rico. So, for example, I'll tell you a personal story. My mom was in Puerto Rico when the hurricane hit. And within, like many Puerto Ricans, we lost contact with her for 2 weeks. We were, crawling up the walls. And I'm the third of five of her children. So we started talking, okay, who can go and find her? So we're like, but that would even be worse because then we wouldn't find you if you go because there's no cell phone. So in any case, to your question about the medical access to medical care. Before the hurricane, my mother was having to travel to San Juan for half of her medical appointments because she couldn't get medical appointments where she was living on the West Coast. So she had to travel 2 hours to San Juan for half of her medical appointments. And so people in Mayagüez, where she has an apartment, are telling her now, even it's gotten worse. You have to go to San Juan for three quarters, of your medical appointments. So that's the situation. And then you have a lot of special cases where you might need a specialist and families are deciding, okay, we can't help our son and daughter here. We'll move to the States where we can get medical help. And that is happening too with education, especially parents with children who have learning disabilities. School closures are rampant in Puerto Rico. They closed already like 25% of schools in the last 5 years. It's K-12 I'm talking about. And so there's been a lot of school consolidations. And the first things that typically go are programs for special ed. So I've talked to families who moved to Holyoke so their kids can go to their appropriate special ed classes. Yes, I think we have time for a couple of more questions.
Yeah, you alluded to the debt crisis. Could you elaborate on how that came about and the island debt crisis?
Yes, well, I'm not a financial expert, so I'll start with that. I'm a literary studies scholar by training. But Puerto Rico has always been kind of like a ground for experimentation for the U.S. So that could be, female sterilization, for example, or industrialization, and any number of things. DET during the Vietnam War, things like that. And I think one of the experiments that the U.S. has done in Puerto Rico is financial. So in the 1980s, Congress passed a law that basically forbade any government, statewide or localwide local level government in Puerto Rico from declaring bankruptcy. That was a law in the 1980s. And then I think Wall Street was behind that law. Because after that, Wall Street started pushing bonds, you know, government bonds to the local municipalities and regional governments and the state government. And so these are like loan sharks, but for government. And so the debt kept going up. The banks kept lending because there was this law they couldn't declare bankruptcy, even though they knew they wouldn't be able to pay back. And it just exploded, you know. It exploded right around Maria. And now there's no longer a democracy in Puerto Rico because Obama appointed a group of people to oversee the budget in Puerto Rico. And so the politicians were elected by Puerto Ricans propose a budget, but then they propose it not to themselves as politicians who were elected, but to this oversight board. And then the oversight board has what Reagan always wanted, a line item veto. So they go in, it's like a, really has highlighted the colonial status of Puerto Rico for Puerto Ricans. One more question, yes?
Oh, well, I did think of some questions, just in terms of, I was just wondering about the nature of Puerto Rico's, their privileges to receive federal government aid. Do they have access to Medicaid? Did they have a choice to participate in the Medicare expansion? Are there the same social programs that are available from the federal government through almost any state?
Yes and no. Yes, because programs like Medicare are state and federal. So they have money from the feds and they have money from the state. And in Puerto Rico, I don't know the exact numbers, but of course Puerto Rico has a lot less money. If it were a state, it would be the poorest state in the nation. And so the state, with bankruptcy basically, is unable to put money into Medicare. And the money that comes in from the feds, I don't know exactly how much that is and what the rules are, if it's a matching, I don't know. But it's a lot less than in other states because of that.
I could just answer that. This is what I work on for a living, so I can actually answer the question, which is all 50 states, Medicaid is an entitlement. So for every dollar the state puts in, the federal government matches it. Puerto Rico is the only one where it's a block grant. There's a set amount of money regardless of the need. And so that's why Congress has to continually appropriate special case for Puerto Rico money for doing it. So that $90 billion of aid, the vast majority of that is not actually aid for the hurricane. It's just the normal amount of money that would go to Medicaid just to take care of the health care needs of the population. And that's really what's being held up in Congress right now. So Puerto Rico, in addition to having the financial situation for a variety of reasons, has this structural problem where they don't have the same access to the dollars for Medicaid that all the other 50 states have. So that's one of the crises, one of the other crises in addition to the brain drain and everything else that the professor has talked about.
Thank you.
Great. That's a great way to close the presentation. Thank you so much for coming, and I'll be here. I'll be outside if you want to keep talking. Thank you.